Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome back to another edition of the Inside Lacrosse Division One Men's Podcast with your host Dan Flynn and the incomparable Terry Foy.
I really thought that was going to be incompetent Terry Foy.
No, we are happy to be back for another week and really appreciate the support you guys have been giving us. Please, if you like what we're doing, share it with a friend, subscribe to it on whatever service you get at iTunes, or rate us on Facebook. Hit us up at Terrence Foy on Twitter or at @D_Fly. Or you can email us at tfoy@insidelacrosse.com and dflynn@insidelacrosse.com.
Which somebody decided to do this past week.
Yeah, we get a few of them.
Yeah. Well, you gotta shout out who it is, because otherwise...
Show him some love, Terry.
Mike Mancuso. Yeah. He only reached out to you. He didn't reach out to me. Why am I shouting him out?
Well, you're part of this team, Terry.
I mean,
and I shared this with you.
You obviously do.
So thanks, Mike, for listening. Please pass it on. And John Douglas III.
Didn't really like my take on behind the back goals versus...
Well, you
got to
mess it up.
Goals.
I think you misspoke.
He understood what I was trying to say. I absolutely stumbled over my point. No question about it. Really, if I were attempting, if my attempt to describe which goal I like better was an actual shot on goal, it would have sailed massively wide of the cage.
You went a little far with that analogy, but I understand what you're trying to do.
Dan, did the Easter Bunny visit the Flynn household this weekend?
Yeah, so you know my person. I'm Roman Catholic.
Yes.
My wife is Jewish.
Right.
And we do...
we're coming in hot with the religion talk on the weekly podcast.
You know, so we have a unique approach to a lot of the religious holidays, and we sort of do both, which I know some people really hate, but I think that's better than doing nothing. So we did. We had some Easter egg hunts and had a nice dinner, and it was definitely Easter. We were dressed up, and it was. We took some family photos.
So
we did some of that stuff without that. I don't know who listens to this. So I'd rather not get into the rest of it. But you know, we celebrated Easter.
So I had this conversation last week, which I was stunned by how many people over the weekend were wishing me a happy Easter. I'm also Catholic, and you know
you went to Loyola,
right? Well, I was also
at
Ignatius. Loyola,
yeah.
And when these wishes were being shared, but I mean, the bunny is like a pretty secular thing. I think the eggs don't really have a lot of bearing in religion either. So you know, certainly the Cadbury.
It's a life, Terry. It celebrates a life and your spirit renewed.
You're
and
absolutely
the growth
right, it
of.
So were you just
hope.
Happy that all of your resolutions were over? We
you
resolved
mean my Lent things.
Yeah, we resolved
to
give up doing
that.
A bad podcast. Clearly, it was not a Lenten resolution.
Well, we struggle.
Might have been a spring 2016 resolution.
Yeah. How about you? You said you were meeting up with your parents.
Yeah, I did. Saw my folks for the first time since winter, since 2015, as a matter of fact. Didn't wish them a Happy New Year because that's one of my big pet peeves.
What is the statute of limitations on the Happy New Year?
2 days.
Well, what if it's someone like you see quite a bit and you just haven't seen them in 2 weeks? Because middle of January, or you're saying 2 days and only 2 days?
Absolutely not. Wish them like a happy divisional round of the NFL playoffs.
Okay. All right. Let's see where you...
I'm
making a point. Yeah,
I'm quite a curmudgeon when it comes to my Happy New Year wishes.
And did you meet them up at the place where you said you were going to meet them, at the casino?
100%. Rocky Gap Casino. Shout out to Sherry.
I've been there.
It's great.
I have been to that place.
Okay.
Did you do any...
I did not play the tables.
No?
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no sports book. Otherwise, I might have put some money down on the Hopkins, Virginia money line.
I told you last week I was getting together with my buddies, and we did. We had a great time Thursday and Friday night. We sat around and watched all the games and did not do well with our wagering. We tried to hit the parlays because they seemed to be the most fun, and we were knocked out of the first bet of the first game each time.
I was going to say, they're the most fun, except that it's kind of like when your bracket gets busted on Thursday of the opening round.
We did hit our final bet of the weekend, which left took a little of the sting out of it, but it was still it was a lot of fun. But just looking at there's one guy who puts in all the wagers, and I'm just looking at my PayPal account, and it's just like, said Rob Crow, $20, said Rob Crow, $40. It's like, it's a little embarrassing.
It's like being in a casino and having gone back to the ATM like six times and then you just get like this. Sorry, bud. Yeah. No, you hit your daily limit for cash withdrawals.
But because we lost so much, we wiped out his online account. But before we were done, he's like, I don't have any more money in my account, guys. You just keep crushing me.
All right, so we have so far covered a very polarizing topic of religion and a very illegal topic of gambling in the United States. So why don't we just talk about something that's equally polarizing, and that is Mike Krzyzewski may or may not have lied in a post-game press conference about sunning an opposing team's player after losing in the Sweet 16.
Yeah, so I know you want to talk about this.
What a somber tone you just
said. I did a little bit of research. Well, I'm going to come off as a homer on this because I'm really with Coach K. Now, I agree. You really shouldn't talk to other people's players. Like, if a guy's woofing or going up and down the court, it's not
the opposing coach's responsibility.
Yeah, responsibility to say, shut up or don't do that. You take care of your own people. But after every game, this guy is the face of college basketball. He is head of our national program. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's the most winning coach of all time. He's pretty well respected. And after every game, there are games where he goes up to every game to the opponent's 2-3 best players or something and says something nice to him. And that's what he did in this one. And the people on the other side of it love it and appreciate him saying that. In this case, this is the way I looked at it. Forget about what the kid did. Like, he's every right to take that shot. He can do whatever he wants. And the kid, Dylan Brooks, was great about it. But it was more about he didn't lie in the press conference. And I went back and looked at it because you said you want to talk about it. There's a guy named Josh Peters from USA Today. He's the reporter who asked the question. So if you guys don't know, this is how an NCAA press conference goes. Usually the winning team goes first, and there's a cooling off period, and then the losing team goes in. And usually the coach makes a statement to start it, and then they usually turn over to the student athletes who are there. And in this case, it was Grayson Allen and Brandon Ingram. And then the press can ask them a couple questions. And then eventually those kids are dismissed because, their season just ended and they just kind of don't want to talk to anybody except maybe their teammates or their family. And then the coach is opened up to questions again from the media. Well, in this case, this guy, Josh Peters, it was still like during the student athlete. And this guy could not wait to get this question out. And he asked, and they actually, the moderator of the press conference like sort of admonished him and said, look,
please hold your questions for the coach until after the student athletes have been dismissed.
Exactly.
I've heard that before.
They went in, and that was about 3 minutes into the press conference. He jumped the gun. So then they let him have the first question, and Coach K answered it. They moved on. 14 minutes later, it's basically the last question of the press conference. They come back to him, and this is what happened, Terry.
We go to Josh for the last question.
Apparently after the game, Dylan said that you told him that he was too good of a player to be showing off at the end like that.
I didn't say that.
Oh, he said of you that you're right.
Huh?
Oh, because he apparently said of you that you're right.
You can say whatever you want. Dylan Brooks is a hell of a player. I said, you're a terrific player. And you can take whatever he said and then go with it, all right? I want to thank all of you. I want to thank all of you, and thank you especially for following us and following us so well during the year.
So basically Coach K said, and this is my take on it, is some guy quoted the player, and all he said was, I didn't say that. And then when the guy said, well, let's get into it more, he's like, look, I just told him he's a terrific player. Let's just move on. And you can say whatever you want or quote the player after that, but I just don't want to talk about it. And I think some of that stuff is, what I say to the guy in line. And what Coach K probably should have said is, hey, that was between me and him. And if he wants to talk about it, that's fine. But I do that all the time with guys, and it's between me and whoever I'm talking to.
So I just want to point out that you took this criticism so seriously that you literally integrated a never done before element of the Inside Lacrosse podcast.
Well, I have
from a technological development standpoint.
I didn't realize I could do this, but now we can. I'm telling you, we're going to try to improve this every week. I have something else later that's pretty good too.
Okay, well, I'm also really excited to not be able to hear that because I'm not plugged into the headphones.
Oh, that's your problem. You didn't bring any phones.
Got to get the cans on the ears, fellas.
Just so you guys know, so I control the mixing board during this thing. And I have headphones on so I can hear stuff and check audio levels better than just an open room. And Terry could not hear what was just being said by Coach K.
Make sure all of your auditory complaints are lodged at DFly, D_Fly.
Send them my way. Send them my way. And if you have any engineers out there looking for some intern credits, please help out too. Okay, moving on, Terry. Have we put that to rest? I liked how it just became a story about what was a non-story and people writing stories that I can't believe we're even talking about this. And then 5 days later, this morning, Mike and Mike brought it up and had a whole segment about it. There have been a round of games since then. It's crazy. It's got to have something to talk about. Got to have something to talk about. And also got to have something to make Grayson Allen to be a villain. In what other aspect of our society is it okay to chastise and vilify a sophomore in college than when it comes to Duke basketball?
College sports in general.
Well, there are...
I remember some people having some problems with Johnny Manziel.
Did he break the law?
No.
Yeah.
He may or may not have gambled and signed autographs.
Those are rules. Those are... And he may or may not have been, you know, underage.
This is also the Inside Lacrosse podcast.
I know. I'm fine taking your criticisms, Terry. We
have something big to talk about.
We do.
We're gonna tip off. We have a new number one.
Is it the first time they've ever been number one in men's lacrosse?
I don't know whether it's the first time the Yale Bulldogs have been number one.
I mean, it's got to have been a long time, right?
Yeah, I can imagine. I believe the 1991-3 range when the John Reese heyday might have been the only other time.
They are 7-0 for the first time since 1990.
Yes.
So it could have been then, but at least in the history, that was USILA probably top 20.
Right. In the history of the Maverick Cascade Inside Lacrosse Media Poll.
Yeah. So in this week's Cascade Maverick Division I Men's Media Top 20, we have a new number one, and it's the Yale Bulldogs coming in hot after their win this weekend. But more importantly, probably the loss of Denver in upset fashion to Penn State, which we will get into in a little bit.
Yeah, it's really, you know, it says a lot for the Bulldogs. I thought that there was a lot of interesting conversation about who should be number one. Certainly our boy Lax Film Room, Patrick McEwen, had a really good argument for Brown. When you consider that they are the most efficient offense, leading the nation in faceoff win percentage, leading the nation in save percentage in goal, and certainly when you compare their defense to Yale's, it is a legitimate conversation. Well, that's a pretty strong case for Brown. That being said...
Who's their best win, Terry?
It is not Maryland. That's Yale's best win, and that's better than Brown's three best wins, which all kind of live in the same category, Harvard, UMass, and Stony Brook. And I think, you know, Quince summarized it nicely. I think comes down to a choice that you have to make as a voter, and I chose Yale primarily because of that Maryland win. And, you know, to varying degrees, a little bit more pedigree with this group, this coaching staff. Not much, just a little bit more in terms of what you might be able to expect from Yale in the postseason in contrast to the Bears.
And Terry's referencing Quint Kesenick's article that he does every Monday on InsideLacrosse.com, where he has some, you know, he sort of goes through his top 20 and outlines his reasons for why they are where they are. But we'll find out a lot about Brown tomorrow.
Absolutely.
They have a big game against Villanova.
Well, it'll probably be today for most of the folks that are listening to this.
That's our first news and note, Terry. And then another news and note, a lot of controversial shot clock decisions this weekend. And there was, you know, I was watching the Hopkins-Virginia game. We discussed that one. I thought there was one in there. There was definitely one in the Marquette Georgetown game, and also in the Carolina-Maryland game.
Well, so, you know, setting the tone a little bit, my stance on the shot clock is relatively similar to my stance toward early recruiting, in the sense that I haven't been as strong or vocal of an advocate of a particular position as many people in the lacrosse media have been. Around many positions. In my opinion, the adjustments that were made to implement the stall warning and 30-second clock have been effective. I think that there's some value in a subjective and not visible 30-second clock as it relates to the mystery or the unknown of when you're going to be punished, whether it be with the beginning of a 30-second clock or the end of a 30-second clock. creates a spirit or an attitude in which a team tries to push tempo faster. And so to that end, it accomplishes some of the goals. That being said, I also know that the lack of clarity around the rule, both in terms of when the shot clock is put on and when it ends, as well as the inability for unfamiliar fans to understand what's going on, is a legitimate problem. So I'm a little ambivalent. I see benefits and I see drawbacks. And what was really interesting to me was the rule cycles are every 2 years. The 2012 rule cycle is the one that implemented the 30-second timer on. The 2014 rules cycle implemented the 30-second shot clock and mandated that it be visible at the Division I level. And there, the 2014 rule decision, in my opinion, was an endorsement of what the timer on rule had done in terms of speeding up the game, removing the ability to stall. I kind of felt like unless there was a watershed moment this season, in the wake of 2015, we were more likely than not going to continue with the 30-second shot clock rule as is. Now I'm not so sure. I wonder if this weekend was the beginning of what could be a public discourse around the sport that is the catalyst for a full 60-second shot clock. So, but Dan, I'm most interested in what your attitude is towards the shot clock debate.
I like the shot clock. I think most fans who watch the sport enjoy the up and down, the pace, the fast, you know, fast break action, fastest game on 2 feet. That being said, there's a right way and a difficult way to implement it. As you said, starting it a few years ago, with no visible shot clock, it was very difficult for fans to understand what was going on and how it was being, how it affected the game. It was not fan friendly at all. Now we have an actual shot clock, but there's still some issues involved. And it's not every place doesn't have one. Like they're trying to institute it into and implement it into some high school. You know, the MIA here plays by college rules, but a lot of schools don't have the shot clock. So it's if you're going to do it, do it. I would suggest doing it, taking basketball's model or whether they do it in the MLL. And it's just like when you get possession, it's on. And then it's just, there's just some consistency to it.
I agree. That's actually one of the nuances of the debate as it is right now that I think the coaches are sorting out in the event that there is a standardized shot clock. And that is whether the shot clock starts when you cross the midline or when you get possession in your own defensive end. I will say I am a huge advocate for starting the shot clock when you get possession to start, because if you otherwise start the shot clock once you cross the midline, you incentivize teams to substitute with the ball in their own defensive end so that they have the maximum amount of time to play offense with their offensive personnel. That really undercuts transition because you're not going to run the ball if you don't think you're going to score. And I think the last thing that anybody would want to see out of a shot clock is undercutting transition.
In each of the three games that I referenced earlier from this weekend, the team that was in question was the team that was behind by a goal. So in the Carolina-Maryland game, it was Carolina by a goal in the first half, and they had possession. And Virginia and Georgetown in endgame situations. So there's some debate about that as well. How can a team who is down a goal with not a lot of time on the clock be stalling?
Well, I actually think that that's a little bit of a red herring. You stall because you don't want to give your opponent an opportunity to score. So if you're down by a goal, there's tremendous reason to run down the clock, take the last shot. You saw it work for Virginia. They scored, went to overtime, and scored 19 seconds into overtime. It unfortunately did not work for Georgetown, because their goal was waved off, and Marquette was able to take the ball to the other end of the field and kill the clock and end the game. So I think that well, the losing team can't stall. It's a natural narrative. I understand where it comes from, but it's not actually correct. Losing teams, particularly teams that are losing by only a goal,
sure,
are oftentimes very incentivized to stall.
And it paid off in one situation, the Virginia situation. So my question about the Virginia game, I have a screenshot that I took. There's 52.9 seconds left in the game. It's right before Virginia calls their last timeout. And you can clearly see that the official, sort of a goal line extended next to the guy with the ball, has the timer on. Yet they go to commercial break where they go to the timeout and they come out, they don't have the timer on. They didn't put it on until about 30 seconds left in the game. So they let them, you know, run around a little bit more. Joe Bresci commented on something similar to that. He came out of a timeout and said, well, they were in a different defense. They were in a zone, and it just took us a while to get into our zone offense. So in situations like that, I asked a college official today how this, and he said that it must have been that the timeout was called
before
and
the
whistle blown
was
before this official in my photo put up the stall warning, or it was almost simultaneous, but they must have got the timeout prior to this guy's warning.
Well, right, and that's one of the ways in which coaches have worked to game the system as it relates to the stall warning. So calling a timeout right before a stall gets called is a tactic. You mentioned, too, it also happened in the Georgetown game. Yeah. They called timeout, came out of timeout, and then had the stall put on them later. Another very substantial issue is
how it's applied.
Possession shots, particularly teams that are becoming better and better at shooting the ball, intentionally trying to miss, to fool referees into thinking that they're actually trying to score. Because in the language of when to apply a stall call is whether the offense is trying to score. When you shoot the ball 10 feet over the cage, sometimes refs are going to think that you're trying to score when, in fact, you actually aren't.
Yeah, and then it's also what key about this Hopkins one is you could see the official whose goal line extender is about to who would make the call. He looks out at the official close to the box, or he looks across the field, and you can see him sort of getting his approval. The trailing official is the one, I think, who keeps the time, and he's looking for his approval to put it on. The coaches can see that, and they can probably – I mean, that's their – okay, it's about to come. Get it now. So they can get their timeout in right beforehand, and I think that's what happened in this case.
No question.
Okay. Terry, you want to move on from this?
To the games.
One more news note I want to talk about. You want to talk about the new aisle issue that's coming out?
Yeah, everybody pick up the April issue of Inside Lacrosse Magazine. It features IMG on the cover. That's their national team. Tahoka Nanacoke is a star on the IMG Ascenders. And Victor High School's Jamie Trimboli.
Why those two schools?
Because they represent emerging trends that also reflect on the history of high school lacrosse. So certainly IMG is the latest in a line of academy-style schools that recruit nationally that have assembled incredibly stacked rosters of talents. Certainly Hill Academy, Culver Military Academy are two other recent examples. I paid special attention to Western Reserve Academy, which was a Northeast Ohio-based school that came to prominence in the late 2000s. And then, obviously, the New England prep school scene, where this has been a long, long-standing style of building a team. And it's interesting, and, it's certainly polarizing and the type of thing that some people don't like about our sport, but it's hard to deny the reality of what it means for prep lacrosse. And on the flip side, there's almost no more pure or organic powerhouse in high school lacrosse than the dominant New York State public high school. And so whether it's West Genesee, which is certainly the gold standard, Ward Melville, more recently West Islip, certainly programs that have historic roots include Yorktown and Manhasset and Garden City, and Farmingdale is one that, was notably won its first state championship a couple years back. Well, I had a conversation with Peter Lasagna, who is well in touch with the Rochester high school scene in the wake of the 2015 New York State High School Championships, and he basically said that Victor High School is not only very good, but they are going to be very good for a very long time. And that made an impression on me. And so when we talked about the 2016 high school preview issue, the disparity in these two storylines struck out to me, and I thought, why don't we make a collage and try to represent both of the storylines?
Good stuff, and you can read that in the newest edition of Inside Lacrosse. Pick up a copy. All right, Terry, on to the games, and what a week it was. The Penn State went to down to Dallas and played in the SMU's Gerald Ford Stadium on Saturday afternoon, and ended Denver's 20-game winning streak, upsetting the Pioneers 15-10. Penn State outshot the Pioneers 33-26, won the ground ball battle 31-27 as Billy Lombardi finished 13-for-28 from the faceoff X, and junior Dan Craig and sophomore Ryan Keenan powered a group of five Nittany Lions with multiple goal-scoring outings, each with a pair of hat tricks.
I mean, first of all, an incredible achievement out of Denver to win 20 straight games, and I think that shouldn't go unsaid. I also think that there's an aspect, if you're within the Pioneer coaching staff, that you're okay with this loss. This is the type of loss that resets the focus of your team heading into the bulk of your league schedule, and certainly beyond that, your conference tournament and the NCAA tournament. This is a team whose aspirations are not to be ranked number one throughout the season or go undefeated. Their aspirations are to win another national championship. For Penn State, you know, it represents the crescendo of what's been a very up and down season. I think that, you know, this was a Nittany Lion team that, coming away from a disappointing 2015 campaign, looked like it had some building momentum, you know, particularly with a couple of interesting results late in the season. And then for the second time in Jeff Tamburoni's career, experienced, you know, the type of tragedy that you can't really go beyond, and that is the death of a player that's currently involved in the program. So that has to be difficult for a team to rebound from, but when you consider how important Connor Darcy was to what Penn State is, it made it even more difficult. And so that is one of the pieces of knowledge that you have to have in order to put their up and down season into context.
And I have Coach Tamburoni's message, emotional message after the game.
I will say this, just taking it away from the value, just the value of having these guys smile after the summer that we went through and the year that we've gone through, and watching these guys tear up and show emotion about a teammate. This is it's a great feeling. So I'm happy for these guys. I'm proud of them. You take anything about RPI or wins out of it, and you just say you can just feel great for these guys that they can smile.
So that was Coach Tamburoni after the game talking about Connor Darcy and what the year or the summer that his teammates have gone through, and how tough it's been on everybody, and how they've sort of come through on the positive side of it and after a tragedy.
And I think that when you know, narrow the focus onto this game, it's funny that you can look at a 13-for-28 performance, sub 50% at the faceoff X, and say this was the deciding factor. But I thought, you know, Coach Tamburoni, who is one of the more insightful coaches in college lacrosse, put it very succinctly. Denver is really good defensively, and they're really, really, really efficient offensively. So if you continue to pile up possession time for them, it makes it so difficult to be successful. Well, winning 13 faceoffs, particularly early, particularly in a going 6-for-6 in a third quarter stretch, you know, that was the deciding factor in the game. And, you know, for Penn State, you can imagine how much this does, both in terms of rallying your focus heading into your Big Ten schedule, as well as positioning you toward the postseason. If you are in bubble contention, a top five win, a top five RPI win, which certainly all indications at this point are Denver will be, can be the difference between getting in and not. And Penn State's best season under Jeff Tamburoni was 2013, when they went 12-5, lost in the CAA championship by a goal to Towson, and got into the NCAA tournament largely on the strength of a top five win versus Denver in a neutral site location. So this is familiar ground for the Nittany Lions. But, you know, I spent a lot of time reflecting on this game after about a 10 to 15 minute conversation with Coach T on Saturday, and put together about 2,000 words. And I was really pleased with, you know, kind of the parallels that I was able to draw between what the first 5 years of Cornell under Jeff Tamburoni was, and what the first 5 years of Penn State under Jeff Tamburoni has been. And it's amazing to me how quickly it seems people around the sport of lacrosse have forgotten about the Jerry Sandusky scandal and what that did to Penn State's athletic department. How different the Penn State athletic department that Jeff Tamburoni is currently a part of is versus the one that he thought he was joining when he took that job in 2010. There are a few other, you know, elements to his career trajectory there that are interesting to look at in retrospect as well. The first is how surprising it was that he took that job when he took that job. This was a guy that was coming off of his third Final Four in 4 years for the Big Red, one of the sport's all-time programs. And then the second is, you know, he joined a team that was in the CAA, you know, Penn State, we think of them now as Big Ten as it gets. Yeah. Funny to consider that in 1992 they were not in the Big Ten. That being said, when Jeff took this job, Penn State or Big Ten lacrosse was not even on anybody's mind. So, you know, so much that kind of a win over a number one team on the eve of your Big Ten schedule puts you in a position to reflect on.
Yeah, and again, Terry wrote a great piece on InsideLacrosse.com. Please go read it. Do yourself a favor. But one of the things that it was interesting to me is during that same period of time, how much coaching transition was happening in the Ivy League. You mentioned that the only Lars Tiffany at Brown and Andy Shea at Yale have been in their jobs prior to 2009. Since then, there's been complete turnover.
No, and there have been more changes since.
Yeah.
You know, Ben DeLuca took over for Jeff at Cornell. Mm-hmm. He's not there any longer. And there's been a coaching change at Dartmouth as well.
Yeah. So it was a very interesting game. Another big game in front of a crowd of about 3,500 fans and a national TV audience, Chad Cohan's overtime winner gave the Duke Blue Devils a stunning 16-15 comeback win over Syracuse Orange. Cuse had leads of 11-6 at the half and 14-10 at the end of three quarters, but Duke roared back with five goals in the fourth quarter to force overtime. Deemer Class was the man of the match. The career-high seven-goal, two-assist performance for Duke. Cohan and Justin Guterding each had a hat trick. Miles Jones had 4 points with two goals and two assists for the Orange. Sergio Salcido posted 4-2, while Dylan Donahue had two goals and three assists in the loss.
Yeah, and to me, this is a conversation about Deemer. He's such an interesting player. One of the conversations I've had numerous times over the last 3 to 5 years with Quinn Kasnick has been about the MIAA, you know, obviously as a Long Islander who lives in Baltimore and who coached for a long time at Boys Latin. He pays a fair amount of attention to the league, and you know, his refrain over that period of time has been the league's athletic edge has diminished. So while the players' skill sets remain incredibly refined, they have been surpassed nationally in recruiting by what the standard of athlete elsewhere in the nation is. And what's interesting about that is that it's manifested itself in a substantial decrease in the amount of MIAA midfielders who are making their mark, to the point where you can kind of name almost all of them, or at least that was true, you know, prior to a year. The last couple of years have actually seen a resurgence, certainly with Ryan Conrad most recently leading the way. But in the meantime, you know, Deemer and Ryan Tucker were the two guys that kind of stuck out as being the exceptions. Deemer certainly being a four-year star. Well, didn't start as a freshman, but, you know, a major contributor. And now a three-year starter at Duke.
And All-American.
No question. I mean, yeah. And, you know, a incredible wingman for Miles Jones. And I think that that's where his you know, story starts to separate, right?
Yeah, well, when you say incredible wingman, I don't mean I feel like that's doing him a bit of a disservice. Yeah.
No, that's exactly
He's
what I was going to say.
He's an incredible player.
So, but here's the thing, is that, like, and not to name drop, but I'm about to. I was texting with Kyle Harrison about Deemer, and he said, he described his game as clean, which I love, because it stands out in my memory. There was a photo of Deemer from Ocean City a couple of years ago, and it was just his shooting motion was identical to a different photo of him playing at Duke. And it was emblematic to me of the fact that this guy is just incredibly fundamentally sound, and he plays the same way all the time. He just strikes me as the type of player that's always in the perfect triple threat position. He's got his stick up, he can shoot, he can pass, or he can pull it down and dodge. Oftentimes, getting back to the conversation that we started with, you know, his athleticism is criticized. He's said to not be have elite level speed or quickness, but I think that against Syracuse, he showed an ability to roll back to his left hand and get off a couple of nice sidearm rips, as well as his ability to spot up and step down with his righty overhand shot. And when you have a teammate like Miles Jones, who you have so much chemistry with, the cleanliness of your game can really emerge to the forefront, because when you do things the right way and your teammates know that you're going to do them the right way, fundamentally speaking, it makes it easier for them to integrate their game into yours. And I think that that's what you see when those two guys are clicking at their best, to the tune of 13 points against a top five opponent at home in a make or break type game for your season.
Yeah, so the Orange fall to 5-2, 1-1 in the ACC. It was Duke's first ACC game of the year, so they're 7-4 overall, 1-0 in the ACC. And it's hard to believe that it feels like we've played a ton of games, but for a lot of these teams, the conference season is just about to start, and really it lays in front of them. I mean, you were just supposed to get better in March, and when April rolls around, it's time to play your conference games and win your conference.
Absolutely. I mean, we've talked at length on this podcast and in other forums on Inside Lacrosse about how there are some detriments to the increased importance of conference play. One of them is the increased number of games in February and March. Teams don't want to play midweek games in April. But one of the biggest benefits is that nobody's season is over. Last week, we talked about Yale, the fact that for the entire history of that program, they faced an uphill battle because they played Cornell and Princeton in their first two Ivy League games. If they went 0-2 in those games, their likelihood of winning the Ivy League was slim and none. With the advent of the Ivy League tournament, they only needed to figure out a way to win two or three games, get into the tournament, stay alive, and then continue to advance. And that's true for almost every single program in college lacrosse right now. I don't think that there's a team out there, a Division I team out there, whose season is over.
Speaking of a team who needed a big win, and it was close to being in the deathbed, is the Virginia Cavaliers. And for the third straight year, Terry, and the fourth time in the last 5 years, Hopkins, Virginia regular season men's game ended in overtime. And for the third straight year, it was the Cavaliers who came out on top, this time as Mike DeMario's goal with just 19 seconds into the extra period was the difference as the UVA gets the win on Easter Sunday. It's a back-and-forth game, featured six ties and loads of momentum swings. Virginia was the one who had the last crack. Cavaliers erased deficits of 10-9, 11-10, and 12-11 in the fourth quarter, with Greg Koholand's goal with 20 seconds remaining in regulation, forcing what else? Overtime.
I mean, so this is 6 out of 8 ESPNU games have gone to overtime? 6 of the last 8?
Yeah, it's been great couple weeks for
I mean
TV.
I don't understand the amount of overtime that they've been paying their employees.
Oh, yeah.
Get it?
Yeah, that's good stuff, Terry.
I mean, it's awesome.
So leave the jokes to me.
With this one, I was at this game last year, and it was the Zed Williams show that gave way to Ryan Tucker and Greg Koholand being as clutch as they are. It was one of those games that you left. It was a night game, beautiful night at Homewood, and you're just like, that's why I love this sport. And it had a similar type of tone. It was a little bit inverted in the sense that at the time, maybe Hopkins was struggling a little bit more than Virginia. And then ultimately what was interesting about it is that obviously the game was replayed in the first round of the NCAA tournament. They changed venues, and the outcome changed dramatically as Hopkins, built on and really pulled away with an enormous lead. I could actually see the opposite happening this year in the sense that, Hopkins, when you look at the wins they already have under their belt, is pretty well positioned. If they can get a couple more, particularly with, we just talked about Penn State, if they get a win over Penn State in the Big Ten, obviously they still have Maryland as well lying ahead. Hopkins' resume could be very good. It could be, the type of 6-7-8 seed that hosts Virginia if they manage to rally and, win two games this week. They've got VMI and Richmond, and then if they can get – it's so here, if we're – I don't have a ton to say about this game because I wasn't able to watch very closely and I haven't been able to watch the replay, but there is one thing that's developing with Virginia's schedule the rest of the way that I want to be on the forefront of, so I'm going to talk about it now. So if they win their next two games, they currently sit at 4-5. They will be 6-5. They could be 6-5 at this time next week. Then they have North Carolina and Duke. They could theoretically lose those two games and go to 6-7.
Then they need to beat. They play Georgetown,
right?
1-8, but it's still a pretty good team.
So say they win that game to go to 7-7. They will be 0-4 in the ACC, which will mean that they'll play Brown in that matchup in Georgia. They will be 7-7 with an opportunity to beat a team that right now would be a top-5 win. Brown won't have very much to play for because they'll be focused on the Ivy League tournament, which is the subsequent week. Virginia is in a position where they theoretically could be in the NCAA tournament but they have to beat Brown in order to be 500. And if they beat Brown, it's the type of win that theoretically could assure them in the NCAA tournament. It's pretty crazy.
Their last scheduled regular season game is April 23rd, which is only 3 or 4 weeks away. There's a long way between then, and I see like
a lot of craziness happening.
I see a makeup game with like Mount St. Mary's or somebody popping up on the schedule somewhere in between the 23rd and when the ACC, when the NCAA selection happens.
I mean, that would obviously be a really interesting development. But that being said, I don't know. The Brown Bears versus the Virginia Cavaliers, who are literally playing for their playoff lives, that could be awesome.
Yeah, that would be a great game. Or it will be. But Virginia, they showed their mettle yesterday, and they've been playing better. They just didn't get any breaks against Notre Dame in a game that they just were right there on the doorstep and couldn't close. Yesterday's game, as a Hopkins fan, I'm watching it, and I feel like I've watched that game many times over the last few years on TV, where Hopkins is ahead by a goal and just can't hold on to the lead. I mentioned this before. So play along with me here, Terry. So most of the time a kid shoots, a good shooting percentage is about 50% of putting it on the cage, right?
Yeah.
All right. And a goalies make about 50% saves. You save at least 50%, right? So the chances of a kid in that pressure situation putting on the cage and getting it past the goalie are fairly low.
I mean,
seems like 90% of the time that ball is going in that like last, the 30 seconds left in a game and you got a desperation shot. It seems like more often than not that ball goes in and then we go to overtime.
It's interesting because of how late game situations tend to be approached by most teams. I mean, we saw, it's funny because Virginia fans are listening to you say, I feel like I've seen this game many times before. And they're like, hey, Dan, we just saw this game last week against Notre Dame. But that's the point that I'm willing to make or looking to make, which is Notre Dame turned to Sergio Perkovic twice for shots. Like, he's a 20-ish percent shooter. There are a lot of guys who are mid-30s to 40% shooters, but they're catch-and-finish guys around the crease. It's just interesting to me how frequently end-of-game situations, offensive coordinators turn to the guy who is most likely to be able to make his own shot, not necessarily a scheme that's going to get an open inside look for a guy. And it's a function of
give the ball to your stud, man.
Yeah, I mean, basically.
But as a goalie, what are you? What's going through your mind?
There's
got to be a ton of pressure on you, and you're just like, hope I see this. Hope it's a good angle. Hope I get in front of this one.
There's nothing better. I actually think that the end lacrosse games that end on dramatic saves are more exciting finishes than dramatic goals. It's a function of how much more rare they are.
Yeah.
You don't really have. I mean, there was the one that stands out in my memory was the Bryan Syracuse NCAA tournament first round game where Gunner made that kick save with like 2 seconds left on the clock after Syracuse had scored.
Gunner Walt, he's talking about it, Bryant.
Absolutely. I think people know who Gunner is.
I'm going to fill people in, give them the whole story. Sometimes, Terry, I think your knowledge is so deep that I don't think you realize that some people don't know everything that you know. And you just drop a name in or tell a story, and you got to give a little bit of background.
Big man Gunner Wall.
But that's what I'm here for.
Keeping me honest.
Yeah, I got to just fill in the listeners. So, good win for Virginia in that one. Terry, the Twitter follow conversation of the week is about the number one ranking.
Yeah,
there's some people losing their mind over this.
Well, right. So I think that there was a tongue-in-cheek conversation that emerged about a WWE title belt style. If you knock off the champion, regardless of what you were ranked prior to that, you become number one. I don't think anybody really believes that. I don't know. But one of the guys who engaged is a guy who deserves a shout-out.
Give it to him. Hit him up.
RPD Lacrosse.
Ryan Danahy.
Yes. He records his own podcast.
Sure.
A rival. A competitor.
But we're above the fray, Terry. Look at us just giving him a shout-out and plugging his show.
He is a friend of Inside Lacrosse. He was an evaluator at the 2015 Inside Lacrosse recruiting invitationals.
And, former college coach.
He is, yeah. So he former assistant at Michigan and Dartmouth, and is a Dartmouth alum, and believes that the Big Green might belong in the top five. And that is the
I think you had him at number five. Yeah.
Yeah. Behind, I believe, Penn State, Virginia.
It's a lot of Ivy League teams.
Yeah, no, he's a big Yale and Brown, rounding out the top five.
Yeah, so go follow Ryan on Twitter and give his podcast a listen, too.
chirp him a little bit too, because he likes to get in Twitter fights.
One more game, Terry, we want to talk about. Maryland, number 6 Maryland defeated number 12 North Carolina 11-8 on Saturday afternoon at it used to be Byrd Stadium. Do you know it's Capital One Field at Maryland Stadium now?
Yeah. What?
I don't know. I just came to be in my consciousness recently.
Like Saturday?
I don't know why. What happened to the Byrd family? I thought they were kind of important to the university.
Oh, I thought it was
state.
B-I-R-D. Just like they really
like. It's B-Y.
Like aviary.
No, I thought it was like Admiral Byrd.
It definitely
right?
was. That was.
Yeah, so now it's Capital One Field at Maryland Stadium. 6 points, career high, 6 points from sophomore midfielder Connor Kelly, and 4 goals from junior Matt Rambo led the way for the Terps.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that people get used to with Maryland. They get better over the course of the season. They figure out who they are. Ultimately, there isn't a ton to be able to be said about this one, because I think that the thing that I took away is Maryland is just better than Carolina. Not better enough that they can blow them out, but better enough that, you know, they built, you mentioned obviously the sequence at the end of the first half, which was a little bit of a separator. And then throughout the second half, you know, extended the lead to 3 and 4 goals. And it felt like Carolina was never a serious threat to make a run and win this game.
Moving on to the week ahead, Terry, we have 9 games between now and next Saturday, highlighted by the game that every fan wants to see. Number 3, Brown at number 6, Villanova. And it's going to get, hopefully, a high-flying, high-scoring game that should be really fun to watch. And that's tomorrow, Tuesday night, maybe today if you're listening, at Villanova.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mainliners are in store for a good one. A lot of subplots to this one. You know, one that I would like to shine a spotlight on. Two of the better respected offensive coordinators in college lacrosse, Sean Kerwin at Brown and Simon Connor at Villanova, going at each other. You know, this is a matchup of non-traditional styles. Certainly Brown gets a lot of attention for their willingness to play early offense, their production, their offensive production out of their poles. Meanwhile, Villanova for the last 5 to 6 years has been a team whose offensive style has been described as motion. That doesn't really mean anything. I like to say that they tend to play more circular. I remember, you know, I haven't had as strong of an opinion or as strong of an impression of Villanova's offense since Kevin Cunningham's departure. But to me, what emblematic the emblem of Villanova's offense was, he at one point was at X. There was no crease, so it was just 6 guys in a circle, and he literally ran 360 degrees all the way around the offense, the restraining box, and then ended up back at X. And I was just like, I don't know what that means, but that is
motion.
That is a hallmark of Villanova offense. But it is effective, and you know, it certainly is exciting to watch, particularly when they're in or when they've got their personnel dialed in, and Villanova, who has struggled with injuries unlike pretty much any other program in college lacrosse over the last 3 years, is dialed in personnel-wise. They did not play at the weekend, so they are fresh. Folks that want to see the Twarton race shape up should check this one out, as Dylan Malloy is certainly a likely Twarton finalist at this point. And then Princeton transfer Jake Ficarro has his name firmly in that conversation as well. So a lot of fireworks should be in store 4 p.m. on the main line at Villanova.
Another game, there's a lot of good games in the Pennsylvania tomorrow, Terry. Number 12, Stony Brook's at Lehigh at 7 o'clock. But over at Penn, number 5, Maryland pays the Quakers a visit at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, so Penn has kind of, I don't know what the right way to put it is, I guess flown under the radar in terms of the types of season they put together, which isn't a huge surprise. They lost to Virginia 15-10 out of the gate, and they also only had a 2-goal win in their opener versus Michigan. And I think that maybe some folks slept on them as a result. They beat Penn State, and I think at that point it wasn't clear exactly who Penn State was. So now they're 5-2. They're coming off of a dominating win over Princeton 2 weeks ago, and then beat Cornell 9-6 at the weekend. So I guess what I'm saying is that Penn's pretty good, and the type of team that could beat Maryland. Senior attackman Nick Doctor is one of the best assist makers in college lacrosse. He's got 20 on the year, but he's started to see some progression from the rest of the offense, particularly freshman Simon Mathias, who has 17 points with 12 goals. And I think that for a team that started six freshmen at times early in the season, those guys have started to settle in. And Penn's a team that, first of all, I wouldn't be stunned if they beat Maryland. And second of all, was probably considered to be on the outside looking in at the early part of the season of the Ivy League tournament, meaning we expected it to be Yale, Brown, Harvard, and then probably Cornell. Well, now they've obviously positioned themselves at 2-0 in the Ivy League to be likely returners to the Ivy League tournament.
Yeah, Cornell and Princeton both 0-2 in the Ivy League, who Penn's beaten. Terry, last week we correctly called the number 20 Air Force at number 11 Duke game as being one to watch for, and what a game that was.
Yeah, so listen to us when we're talking about all these midweek games.
Yeah, you got to check them out. But you have a note here that says the Zoomies upset the Blue Devils.
Yeah, Zoomies, that's a nickname for the Air Force.
I have never heard that before.
It's a good one, right?
I don't agree. I mean,
you don't agree that it's a real nickname, or you don't agree?
I don't agree it's a real nickname.
You think I just made that up?
You might have.
Okay, well, then let's
But I just talked about it, so
decide.
The joke's on me, I guess.
Yeah, you just pulled the wool.
Ron Burgundy, right, me, like, hey, why don't you read what's here? But there's lots of TV action this weekend and some great games. Check out the InsideLacrosse.com, the Maverick Cascade game calendar. Some of the games are broadcast games. Notre Dame at Syracuse, probably the highlight, 5 o'clock on Saturday. And Penn State at Ohio State at 1 o'clock, also on ESPNU.
Yeah, check it out. It's going to be a really great weekend. A lot of lacrosse on TV. Hope for bad weather because then you get to stay inside and watch it all. But if it's good weather, go to a game.
Yeah. A couple other games. CBS Sports Network, Denver at Georgetown at noon. Maryland at Michigan on the Big Ten Network at 1 o'clock. And then on Sunday, Loyola and Colgate at 2 o'clock on CBS Sports Network. Terry, where are you going to be this weekend?
Well, we're still figuring that out right now. You know, the Syracuse Centennial Celebration is scheduled for Friday night. Would definitely like to be a part of that. So if everything comes together, that's where I'll be, which would then parlay itself into being at Syracuse Notre Dame, 5 p.m. on Saturday, and then being in Central New York to watch the Orange play in their Final Four showdown in men's hoops at 9 p.m. on Saturday evening.
Yeah, I got to give some credit to the Orange. Some people didn't think they belonged in the basketball tournament. We have at least two Syracuse alums that work here at Inside Lacrosse, and another one who works, Robin, who works on my team here, that is a huge Orange fan, just from Ithaca, and congrats to them. They're loving every minute of this.
No question.
Final Four. Terry, finally, our last segment of the day, new words to live by. And we're going to go to our own Quint Kesenick on this one, ESPN fame. Follow him at @QKesenick on Twitter. And he said in his article, posted today in his top 20, that the lacrosse ball is a symbol of all the combined work a team has invested. Fight for it.
Sounds to me exactly like how you would approach an Easter egg hunt.
Yeah, little Hannah Flynn running after, checking out, picking up the Easter eggs. But it's true. It's the effort and the hustle that you put into that is you know, manifests all the hard work that you put into the preparation of the season. And you got to value the possession of the ball.
Absolutely. Don't turn it over. Fight for it.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Again, reach out to us at @D_Fly or at Terrence Foy on Twitter. Or email us at tfoy@insidelacrosse.com and dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. Pass it on to a friend.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah.
Really, seriously, we would really appreciate it. If every single one of you told one person about it, that'd be sick.
Yeah. Have a great week, everybody, and enjoy the games.